this morning we're going to be, I mean this afternoon, we're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 3162, then on House Bill 3186. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3162. Mr. Keller?
House Bill 3162 abolishes Certificate of Initial Mastery and Certificate of Advanced Mastery, directs the Department of Education to contract with independent educational assessment organization to develop and implement statewide assessment system, prescribes requirements for statewide assessment system, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005, and the bill does not have a subsequent referral.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. I would like to accommodate our legislative colleagues, so if I can call Senator Starr and Representative Crummell and Representative Thatcher for it.
There you go.
Thank you. You can go, Senator Starr, and of course, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm State Senator Bruce Starr, House, or Senate District 15, representing Western Washington County. I'm pleased to be here today, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 3162. I just got some brief testimony here that I will read, and turn it over to my legislative colleagues, and I appreciate the courtesy since I do have another appointment to get to. House Bill 3162 addresses an issue that has been discussed and debated at length in the legislature since SimCam was first enacted in the early 1990s. Each legislative session, the issue of unfunded mandates is a topic of great discussion. I submit that the passage of House Bill 3565 in 1991 created one of the largest unfunded mandates ever for Oregon's local school districts. Every session since, there's been debate over various aspects of the School Reform Act. Every session, there's been a debate about the state not providing enough funding to implement the law. This is the session to pass House Bill 3162 and end the debate and free local school districts from the SimCam mandate. The facts have shown that schools spend much-needed state resources on a program that college admissions do not consider when reviewing applicants, and that employers do not consider when hiring future employees. As I'm sure you are aware, the House Audits Committee recently conducted a report that found that SimCam has been costing the state almost $60 million a biennium. Further, the report goes on to show that if SimCam were to be eliminated, the state could save $8 million at the Oregon Department of Education alone. I'm sure Representative Crummell will go into more detail there. With the new requirements handed down from the No Child Left Behind Act, SimCam has become nothing but a distraction for schools trying to implement new mandates. With school budgets tight once again, this is the session to eliminate SimCam and give our local school districts much-needed relief. Passing House Bill 3162 will allow 198 school districts to redirect classroom dollars that are currently being wasted on an unnecessary program to the classroom where they can be used to lower class sizes or make other necessary improvements. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. Stand ready to work with members of this committee and my fellow legislators to help create an environment where our schools are not bogged down with programs that take away much-needed dollars from the classroom. That ends my written testimony. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm encouraged by the fact that we're having a hearing on this bill today, and I'm hopeful that that this committee will report this bill out to the full House and send it over to the Senate where we can continue the work. So thank you, Madam Chair, for my opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Did you flip a coin?
Okay, I'll go first. He will be a lobbyist in his next term. For the record, I am Kim Thatcher, representative from District 25, and I thank Madam Chair the opportunity to testify. And mine's just real brief. I don't have a prepared comment for you, but I was one of the people that sponsored a bill to eliminate the SimCam. So I thought I'd be remiss if I did not come up here and tell you what some of my reasons were. And I'm not actually going to address all the money that I'm sure will be discussed by people following me. But when the SimCam system was implemented, of course, we all had high hopes that this would be a great thing to do, that we would be able to educate our kids with world-class standards. And I just think that the experiment has not delivered what was promised. We don't have these results that we can really track what kind of progress is being made through these tests. What I wanted to talk about is the fact that I do have three kids in public school, and every minute that is being spent teaching them how to take the test, the mechanics of the test, not the subject matter, is wasted time to me. That's a lost opportunity for them to learn the basic reason that they're in school to begin with. It's not to learn how to take a test and the mechanics of it. It's there to get an education on the subject matter that is included in the test. And that's where I feel like this testing scheme has failed. And I would support the abolishment of this standard. And I also want to add that my oldest daughter just applied to several colleges during the summer, and none of them cared that she had graduated with a SIM graduation certificate. It just didn't matter. So,
thank you, Representative Thatcher. That would leave Representative Crummell.
Yes, the beast gets to go last. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, and I come to you as Chair of the Audits Committee, which, as you are well aware, the Audits Committee took 2 days of testimony regarding the assessment system in the state of Oregon and the resultant of the SIM and the CAM. And, of course, one of those days of testimony that we took was with this very committee at Wilson High School. You will also remember that not very many people at that hearing spoke favorably towards the SIM and the CAM. And additionally, in an additional day of hearing, the department stayed pretty much neutral, providing us with a lot of information from a standpoint of their cost, but not necessarily coming in and advocating in favor of the SIM and the CAM. And you'll also remember that there were other organizations, the Oregon School Boards Association and COSA, that also were not necessarily fond of SIM and CAM. I would just point out, I hope that you did receive a copy of the report. You were supposed to have received a copy of the report from the Audits Committee. And I would just point out a couple of things. Of course, Senator Starr already alluded to the $60 million of biennium and the $8 million of biennium in savings that can be that can be redirected as far as the classroom is concerned. Representative Thatcher also pointed out the fact that no college and no employer, and as you will remember, I believe it was in the joint hearing that we had, that the that it was pointed out that not even Western Oregon University has a place on their application form for the SIM to be recognized, and none of the employers ask for it either. So really, there's not a value add. The other thing that I would point out is that every high school in the state were to do this, and that is to close for a day. It doesn't necessarily have to be the same day statewide, but over the course of a school year, if every high school in the state were to close for a day, that would be a cost of $7 million. Now, I'm not saying that $7 million in savings, but that $7 million in lost opportunity from a standpoint of our kids getting the education that they so richly deserve. And I just point that out because if during the course of the school year a high school has to close for SIM-related activities, then I think that the cost overall is much more when you add in the $8 million that we have talked about with the Department of Education, as well as the other $38 million that we've been able to identify that is expended by school districts throughout the state. So when we're looking at it simply from a cost standpoint, SIM and CAM really have outlived their usefulness. I would also just like to point out that the bill, the present bill that you are hearing, does follow one of the recommendations that we made based on testimony and other information that the House Audits Committee obtained, and that is on page 7 of the report that we sent to you, where recommendation number 4 is to instruct the Department of Education to contract with an independent educational assessment organization to implement a standards-based objectively scored value-added assessment system to meet all requirements of the federal No Child Left Behind Act of 2001, and I would add nationally normed. One of the flaws in our current assessment system is the fact that our tests are not nationally normed, so we don't know where Oregon kids stand in relation to other kids in the country. I would also just point out, and this is more anecdotal than anything else, a couple of things. One is at Sherwood High School, which is in my district, they have what's called the SIM room. The SIM room is where all of the SIM work is stored. It is a classroom. Now, that's one school district that is growing so fast they can't keep up with the space, and yet they're taking a classroom to store SIM materials. Now, talk about a waste of space and a waste of resource. That's, to me, that's it. The other thing that I would just anecdotally say is that being a substitute teacher in the 9901 interim, I had the opportunity to be the proverbial mouse in a corner in teachers' lounges and other places, and I worked in 5 different school districts on a very regular basis. And anyone who would purport that teachers support the SIM and the CAM have not been listening to the teachers. And so I would say that that the teachers, based on what I heard, and this is away from the test, based on what I heard when I in the lounges, having lunch and around other conversation, they don't support it. They wish it would go away. They feel like it won't go away. I think House Bill 3162 is a very good step in that direction, and I wholeheartedly support it, and would welcome it coming to the House floor. I'd be glad to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Crummell? Well, Representative Roblin, Representative Farr will go right on down the line.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I had is that, you know, it says about $8 million savings on the performance tests. It doesn't show much savings on the other, and I assume that's because we are going to have to do some tests. And do we have any costs on these norm reference, these national tests, what it would cost the state to provide those for all school districts?
That's the one thing, Madam Chair and Representative Roblin, that's the one thing that we do not have at this point, and audits did not pursue. I can tell you that Doug Costi from the Department of Education had told us that he was moving towards or trying to move towards getting an RFP, request for proposals, from a testing organization to see what the cost would be and see what kind of savings that might be able to be generated by going to that type of a system, with regards to there will be, and that's why we only identified $8 million in savings, because there are going to be costs associated with it. There right now on SIM and CAM in a biennium, the State Department of Education spends about $20 million. So, and we know that there's still going to be expenditures because of No Child Left Behind. The $8 million is simply what we were able to estimate as a savings would be.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Crummell, I'm seeing some discrepancy in figures here. Just looking at the committee could identify nearly $60 million per biennium spent on the SIM and CAM, and yet when I look at the figures by ODE, which is on page 4, I see that they say we'll spend over $20 million, and then on page 5, COSA said that it translates to about $38 million. So I'm just wondering where the $60 million came from.
Okay, if you, Madam Chair and Representative Farr, if you go to the back of the report, you should see the exhibits. And so let me, rather than trying to wade through all of the narrative in the report itself, the last two pages of the report are the exhibits. And if you look at, first of all, if you look at Exhibit 2, that shows the cost to the Oregon Department of Education for the assessment system in the 03-05 biennium, and that shows $20,232,899.
We don't have that. We don't have that in our... That.
Oh, you don't?
We're missing that page.
Oh, okay.
We got it. We saw on page 7.
Yeah.
Oh.
So apparently nobody has page 7.
Okay.
I apparently didn't grab the exhibits on the way down.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's right here.
Okay. I believe you.
So I'm not just making this stuff up.
Hold the COVID study for the camera.
Oh.
No.
Okay. Well, when you do get a copy of the exhibits, Madam Chair and Representative Farr, you will note that under Exhibit 2, it shows the cost to the Oregon Department of Education is $20,232,899. And that's for the 03-05 biennium, and so we're anticipating for the 05-07 biennium that cost, of course, would go up. Then Exhibit 4 is where we have, and we did a sampling of 18 school districts, and this was based on an email that the OSBA and COSA, that COSA had sent out. And then we had a little formula that we plugged in to, it would have been a great sim exercise. We had a formula that we plugged in to extrapolate out what the costs were statewide based on this sampling of 18 school districts. And we had costs, on the school districts that answered on the survey everywhere from very little $10,000-$15,000all the way up to $500,000. So there was quite a discrepancy in terms of what a district is paying. One of the things that I would point out, and this is where it gets kind of boring, but there's in the database initiative, there's a function code called function code 2230, and these are SIM or assessment related activities is what function code 2230 is. Some school districts, Portland for example, puts down zero, and other districts have added everything, not everything, but they've added everything that could possibly be SIM related, and so they've actually tracked their costs very well. But when we added all this together and did the extrapolation, we came up with $38,278,673 per biennium. So when you add the cost to the Department of Education and the cost to the school districts that we were able to identify, that's where you get to close to $60 million a biennium.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question. I know I circuited this route to get there, but I wanted to make sure that you understood that.
Yes, and I think it would be very helpful if we could have page 7.
We have page 7.
Yeah.
I think we can make sure that your committee administrator
you're right.
Does.
We do have page 7. Page 8, excuse me. Page 8 would be helpful.
we will make sure that you do have that information available.
Great.
Additional questions for Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Jerry, for bringing this idea forward. I definitely agree with the idea that testing might be overblown and that we might need to take a look at whether or not we are spending a disproportionate amount of time teaching to the test. I guess my question is, looking back at those teachers that you were listening to and hearing them talk about their different views of the testing equation, do you think they'd also be concerned about the testing requirements of No Child Left Behind, even if we did get rid of SIM and CAM?
Madam Chair and Representative Shields, that's a great question, and yes, they will. Teachers are kind of an interesting lot, and being one, I can feel free to make comments about my own profession, and some of the teachers out there will be saying, "Well, that dirty, rotten turncoat." But there are a number of teachers out there, and don't get me wrong, teachers work hard, and I appreciate what they do in the classroom, and I appreciate what they do when they're not in the classroom as well, and all of the work that they do at home and after hours and before school and so on. But I think that the one thing is that we would rather be autonomous and be able to do things our own way. And I'm speaking as a teacher now when I say that, and I include myself in that group. I would much rather be autonomous and be able to do things my own way. Doesn't necessarily mean that I can, but I would certainly like to. When you have the state or you have somebody else telling you that there's something that you have to teach, or there's this apparent mandate, it becomes a little bit disconcerting for us, and we would much rather not do that. So quite frankly, we would rather not have somebody telling us that there's this test out here. But at the same time, we recognize the value of assessment. Where it starts getting complicated is when you start having to add rubrics in and all kinds of other complicated sorts of things. One of the things that I've never understood, and I would actually lay at the foot of our teacher training institutions, that I don't think they do a good job of, and that is teaching teachers how to assess their students from a standpoint of a pretest, posttest. I've always done this as a teacher, most notably at the college level. My students always hated the first day because when they walked in, after going through many parts of the agenda for the year or for the term, they were handed their first test. And it's because I wanted to know what they knew. Because that way, at the end of the term, I could assess whether or not I was able to impart any knowledge to them. So it's one of those things that I think that, you know, we should be teaching in our teaching institutions is for teachers to do a pretest and a post-test and to assess whether or not their students really are making headway. But that is also the job of some of the nationally normed statistical valid assessment tools that are out there, and they are already there. The one thing I objected to in 1993, when Sim and Cam were starting to be developed, and the work that was being done by the Department of Education, was this attitude that we had to do our own. That, you know, Oregon is special. Yes, it is. Oregon is a special place. But you know what? The kids in first grade here, and third grade here, and fifth grade here should be learning about the same thing as they are in Iowa and California and Texas and Florida and New York and everywhere else across the country. And to say that we needed to develop our own assessment tools, I think it created the first flaw in the system, and I think what it really did was created an unreliable, invalid way of assessing our students, to which we've been basically throwing this money away. Now, you know, sort of just speaking as a teacher, that, you know, if I had my choice of giving the Iowa Basic and giving the assessment tool that is produced by the state of Oregon, I'd pick the Iowa Basic.
Thank you. Representative March?
Thank you. And I'm sorry Representative Thatcher isn't here, but she made the comment that time teaching how to take the test is wasted. Is that sort of your assessment as well?
Madam Chair and Representative March, I think any time a teacher is just strictly teaching to a test, then I think they're missing the point. And actually, in the early 90s, I found myself defending what the legislature had done and trying to help my teaching colleagues understand that I felt that, you know, that it was necessary for us to be doing assessments, and that they should not be teaching to the test. What they should be doing is teaching what should be taught at kindergarten and first grade and second grade and third grade. And by the time we have a child in the third grade, they should be able to read, and we want them to be able to read at third grade level, not reading it at kindergarten or first grade level, and those sorts of things. I think if we let ourselves get caught in this attitude that we're going to teach to the test, then I think we do a real disservice to the students and to the parents The parents aren't getting what they paid for. The students aren't getting a fair shot. And quite frankly, that causes teachers to just get lazy.
Follow up. Well, thank you, and I'm glad you clarified that, because I agree. I don't think we should be teaching to the test, but teaching how to take a test is a very lucrative business. And for example, Kaplan's LSAT exams, a lot of people pay good money to teach people how to take tests, and I think that's not something that's wasted on our students. If we're teaching them how to handle themselves under pressure, how to take an exam, not what to answer the exam with, but how to do that process. I think that's a valuable learning experience.
Madam Chair and Representative March, I would agree that teaching a person how to take a test can be very valuable, especially when you have students that get hypertest anxious. That is a real problem for some students. They just get so blown away by this fact that they've got this this thing that they can't look up the answer to. But at the same time, I don't think you shouldn't have to take an entire day or 3 days or a week or however long it's been purported to be taking to teach a child how to take a test. The other thing is teaching to the test. If we're teaching the breadth of what should be offered in the curriculum, that really shouldn't be an issue.
Thank you. And for clarification, I haven't checked Western's application online, but if you go to Eastern Oregon University, Oregon State University, and I believe PSU University, in their downloadable form, you'll find the SIM is referenced, and the requirements for the SIM counts for the pass.
All right, that's good to hear. Thank you.
Representative Dolan.
I'm going to ask Representative Crummell if you might. When we talk about test angst, and when you held your committee hearings, particularly at Wilson, was there particular angst by students at taking the SIM? Did they see it as something that was high stakes, that had an outcome on their future?
Madam Chair and Representative Dolan. No, the feeling that I got from the testimony that was given by the students was that they felt that the taking the SIM tests were a waste of time. They didn't see the SIM activities as being something that added real value to their educational experience, and they didn't see how this information was used in furthering their educational experience, going to college or going to trade school or getting a job.
Thank you very much, Representative.
I do have a statement with a question in addition. Just the statement is that the individual school districts decide what the curriculum is going to be. You know, they purchase their science curriculum. It's not uniform. And so I think the idea that teachers will never have to teach to the test, you know, for lack of a better one, I think that's false, because there's no way that we're going to purchase an off-the-shelf test that's going to be uniform with every curriculum that each school district has. So, you know, you're going to be able to test them on the knowledge that you're giving them, but still, those tests aren't necessarily going to be asking them to spit out the information that you've taught them. There's still going to be a lot more and different things, but I think that can be used as a teaching tool. I don't think the time has to be wasted, and I think good teachers do find a way to give that information to their students and make it interesting so that they have the answers to the questions.
Representative Roebling.
Was there a question in there?
Oh. Well, my question was... Okay, I'm sorry. My question... Wait. Follow up, Madam Chair? Because Representative Crummell is demanding a question, and I think I can come up with one.
Then please follow up.
Can you tell me, or can you provide any instances where off-the-shelf testing would conform to the curriculum that school districts offer?
Madam Chair and Representative Farr, I would argue that the tests that are given currently don't necessarily align. They align with the curriculum from the standpoint of general topics, but the tests that are currently given, whether they're given online or by paper pencil through the Department of Education on the instrument that's currently used, does not necessarily align specifically to any one school district's curriculum. And I don't think you're going to find that occurring with any product that's out there. I don't care whether it's the Iowa Basic or the actual instrument that's used here, the assessment instrument used here in Oregon. What you want these tests to do is assess at certain points in a child's education the general knowledge that they have. And there's going to be some specific sorts of things, like, for example, the equation of 2 plus 2 equals 4. We do know that's a specific sort of, but the general knowledge is the student can exhibit a way that they know how to add. I mean, so there's the sorts of things that you're looking at. The performance measures that we've gone through have been, and they've actually been found to be statistically invalid, which to me then means, you know, that's sort of like money we've poured down the drain that we can never recoup that investment. We can never recoup that cost.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This one has to do with some of the teaching to a test issues. One of the big issues on that one have been the performance exams, in particular math problem solving and the writing, which we teach a lot about how to take the test in those because it's uniquely different than it is in the multiple choice. So the question I have is that, and I'll specifically go to the writing. The writing rubrics or the rules that they have for the test are things that, in general, do you believe need to be taught anyway? I mean, if you look at things like conventions, things like the other rubrics that are there, do those need to be taught regardless of whether we do performance tests? The criteria that were developed for what good writing looks like are still things that probably need to be taught. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Madam Chair and Representative Roland, I do not disagree with that statement. I think that there are, in terms of writing mechanics and good sentence structure and good paragraph structure and how to structure a paper, whether it be a persuasive paper or it be a paper to impart specific knowledge, research, that sort of thing, and even then, you know, understanding how to footnote and all of those sorts of things, I think are extremely important. We have to teach them at, when they're age appropriate, obviously, and so a third grader is not necessarily going to understand footnoting and everything, but by the time they're a junior in high school, they should understand those things. So I don't disagree with the statement that you've made. What I do object to is that it can become, in a performance measure, it can become too, and you know, for me to be talking about not wanting performance measure, but in a performance measure standpoint, it can become too subjective. And I think that's the issue that we start getting into and why then it starts becoming, the instrument starts becoming invalid.
Thank you. Any further questions for Representative Crummell? Thank you very much, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'd call Robert Wilmer.
Thank you, Chairman Flores, members of the committee. I'm Bob Wilmer, Executive Director of the Oregon International Council. Doesn't mean much to many people. It's a nonprofit organization I helped establish in 1983 to help carry out the recommendations of the Oregon Governor's Commission on Foreign Language and International Studies, which I had served on assignment from the U.S. State Department. And I retired from the State Department to work with Oregon Education. I was impassioned to do this by my experience of 25 years in the Foreign Service that persuaded me the most serious problem our country has in the world is at home, with a population that isn't really sure the world is out there and certainly not very well informed about it. There are exceptions, but I felt very strongly that most Americans needed to know more about the world. And the longer I stayed with it, it seems to me the more Americans know I need to know generally. It has struck me that our standards of education were not coming up to world standards. Admittedly, for a lot of the world, education is an elite process, and we're trying to educate everybody, but there gets to be a disconnect there, and a lot of Americans, it seemed to me, were getting ill-educated and not realizing it. Oregon has taken some constructive steps to deal with this, and I think the SIN standards are an important effort in that direction. Specific knowledge of languages, several plural languages, science, math, and the social sciences, as well as arts and other aspects of human behavior, are important. And I think that I hear the phrase high risk, high stakes assessment as if it's a terrible thing. But my impression has been that the world exacts high stakes assessments from us all the time. And if the schools don't prepare us to face that kind of assessment, they aren't doing a very good job. And with that in mind, I think the SIM is a very valuable tool, at least potentially. I think it's more valuable, for instance, than the No Child Left Behind Act, which, from all I can gather, is a pretty minimalist effort to set standards. And I think we can do better than that. And I think the SIM can help us do that. I'd have to say in passing that I'm not very impressed by the CAM. I would really question, from what I've seen in some other countries, the desirability of career specialization in high school. But if we could get kids to actually qualify for the SIN in high school, I think we'd all be better off. And a few basic assumptions about education that drive these observations, if I may. I start with the premise that the first purpose of public education is to prepare citizens to run a democracy. Education bears substantial economic benefits as well, but without a functional civil society, which depends largely on the competence and engagement of the main body of our citizens, we don't have an economy, which is all the more reason that a good education is important for all citizens, not just the elite. Secondly, educational success is a joint responsibility shared by educators and students and families in the community. All of them have an interest in the results. It can't be turned over to the professionals. It has to be something all of us are engaged in, and especially the students. And I think the SIM is terribly important in making clear to the student that, yes, there is some goal of learning you have to strive for here. Easy tests aren't going to do it. And education is not a mechanical process that you can just plug in these units and these processes and it'll work out like a factory. It's much more of an organic process where you plant the seed and you water it and you fertilize it and you hope it grows. But you know you cannot control this process. It depends on too many factors. So you have to keep working at it, and you can't be surprised when things don't come out quite as you expect. And thirdly, we cannot achieve the goals we proclaim without recognizing that real standards inevitably carry the risk of disappointment. We can't guarantee the results any more than a farmer can guarantee a specific crop yield. Maybe they can, but within a certain range. But you have a lot more unknowns and you're dealing with educating kids than with planting a seed. And I think we have to focus on a concept that's pretty well accepted in the gymnasium, no pain, no gain. And if we tell kids, don't worry about the test, it's not important, well, some of them will learn anyway, but a lot of them will goof off. I would. And so unless we are serious about the standards that we expect of the kids, I don't think we can expect the kind of reaction, the kind of success we really hope for, at least I hope we hope for. And I thought for some years that one reason kids respect athletics more than they do academics is the standards there are very clear.
You've got to get the ball through the basket. You've got to get across the goal line, or it doesn't count. Now, I admit that academic activities are a lot more complex than that, but that sort of incentive, I think, is very important. The results depend on what the student does, and we can provide the incentives, but it's up to the student to do the learning, and we cannot forget that. And I think this is the real value offered by the SIM, and it's an imperfect instrument. It's developed by human beings in an imperfect world, but it has struck me as being potentially extremely effective. The area, I might add, where I've had the most direct experience has been in foreign language teaching. I'm also executive secretary of the Oregon Foreign Language Association, and they've done in this state some very remarkable pioneering work, working with the university system to develop an oral interview aimed at the PASS standard. The teachers in this state produced a test unlike any other. And the process of training, we trained about 500 teachers to use it, where they carry on a scripted conversation. The kid draws a card, and that card triggers some questions, and the teacher is trained to evaluate the answers. The idea is to get the kid actually communicating in the language. Well, by the time we finished training 500 teachers in this, a lot of them were taking the test to use in classroom because they found it a very good teaching tool. So we had to develop a much larger range of questions to give the test continued validity. But what I'm getting at is this is a test that is an extremely valid learning statement of learning goals. And it measures, if the purpose of learning a language is to communicate in it, this test tests your ability to communicate in the language. That's probably easier to do that with languages, where you can measure performance more readily than probably in some of the other academic areas. But I think it's an example we need to bear in mind about the validity of tests as a teaching implement. And the SIM has been criticized for its ambiguous status, but I think that ambiguous status comes from us. We haven't made it clear that the SIM is what you have to graduate. I'd love to see that happen, because I think that would set some really significant standards. I was listening into the State Board of Education when they adopted the first SIM standards back in the 1990s. And Bill Koresh, who was then superintendent of Lake Oswego, was sitting on the board. And after they adopted the standards, he said, "Well, I want the board to understand that these standards we've adopted for the SIM, with my support, require of 10th graders performance that most high school seniors could not now produce." I think that's the real reason the SIM was allowed to go to fade away. It was too demanding, not that it was inadequate. And that's what bothers me about this whole process. I mentioned the Oregon University System's PASS assessments adopted in the 1990s, and the work the language teachers did with them to develop an appropriate test. And I have to mention our extraordinary disappointment when in 2002 the State Board of Higher Education decided not to require the PASS system for university entrance. A decision they made without public discussion and without exploring the possibility of using the SIM test. When we asked them about that, the response was, "Oh, that's controversial." Making me wonder, what are we trying to do with education if we're afraid of any controversy? If we want to only administer a test that everybody can pass, what are we up to? I have to say, I think a lot of the negative experience we have had comes from what I've come to think of as the coalition of the unwilling. There are a lot of, I've heard quote reference to a number of teachers say they don't have much interest in the SIM, they don't like it. They'd rather, and Representative Crummell mentioned that, you know, teachers would like to be autonomous. Well, every profession would like its autonomy. Every human being would like to be a law unto himself, but I don't think we can expect that, especially not in a profession that's paid for by the public. We have to accept there are rules we have to live by, and we have to accept there are standards to which we work. And so with that in mind, I tend to be very dubious of a lot of the criticisms of this SAM. And others' criticisms, I'm afraid, the question, for instance, how much is the cost of the SIM, how much of the SIM cost is additional to what the school should be doing anyway if they're doing appropriate tests? And this coalition of the unwilling, I'm afraid, includes some people who would like to get rid of standards out of laziness or complacency. But I can't escape the feeling that there's some people who want the public schools to fail. Maybe to divert the money to some other purpose. Just so they can concentrate on what they want to do. But I'm very much afraid that the model we head for in that approach is the model you see in some Latin American countries, where the elite have their own schools, and they send their children to those schools. And people who send their children to public schools, well, they don't matter anyway. I would hate to see this country come to that situation. And yet I'm afraid that that is implicit in this fear of pushing for high standards in the public schools. And with that in mind, I'm afraid that if we do abolish the SIM, the message the students will draw is one from Charlie Brown. There's no problem so big and so complex that it can't be run away from. And that message will not be missed by our students, who will say, see, it went away. And by the way, I used to hear that from educators, and I heard it from the chairman of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, who was a school superintendent in the 1990s, when we went to demonstrate a foreign language assessment for him, for the commission. He took me aside at the intermission and said, well, all this standards stuff is going to go away. It always has before. And I think that's what a lot of people are looking for. And that, I think, would be a disaster for this country and for this state. So with that in mind, I hope the committee will reconsider plans to cancel the SIM and resolve instead to make it mandatory for a full credit high school diploma. Then everybody'd know what it was for. And I think it could lead to vast improvements in education. It's not perfect, nothing is, but I think it deserves our more serious attention than we've given it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wilner. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. I would just like to make one comment, and that is to your statement that there perhaps there could be some who would like to see public education fail. Considering that it does involve our children, I think I'm not aware of one person who would like to see public education fail, but to succeed, because it does involve our most precious commodity, that of our children. So I would just like to give that little pushback to you.
Well, I hope that's the case. I keep feeling there are exceptions.
Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Thank you. Fleming and Pat Burke.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Fleming, Deputy Superintendent at the Irving Department of Education. And Dr. Burke will introduce himself. We've asked Doug Costi to come up with us in case you have any additional questions about the assessment system or the costs, et cetera. He's been working on those numbers, as you know. Just like to provide a brief overview statement. We are aware that you have a stack of bills before your committee that create major policy changes for Oregon's public education system. And you're beginning that discussion today with two of those bills. We wanted to take this opportunity to indicate our willingness to work with the committee on these proposals, but we'd like to offer some context for your deliberations and the future discussions that you'll have for the rest of your committee hearings. Each legislative session since 1991, when this body passed Oregon's Educational Act for the 21st century, both the Oregon Legislature and the U.S. Congress have passed additional legislation which creates policy and directs the work of the Oregon Department of Education and Oregon school districts. We currently have perhaps the greatest challenge we have ever had with implementation of No Child Left Behind, and we are anticipating the reauthorization of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and the Perkins Vocational Technical Education Act in this congressional cycle, in addition to the continuation of implementing the mandate for Oregon and Oregon's system. No Child Left Behind comes to us with the promise of greater flexibility for how we spend the money, but it also comes with much greater accountability. It states higher expectations for the nation's schools and for the success of all students, and you've heard a lot about that in your committee hearings. There's been discussion at the congressional level about block granting, and there also is much discussion about the elimination of several entitlement funding streams, merging those into or blending those into different funding mechanisms with different requirements attached to them. In our State Board of Education and State Board of Higher Education policy discussions, there's been a great deal of conversation about a pre-K-20 or a P-16 system, depending on who talks, who uses which time frame. That is about really the intention behind that discussion is how do we improve outcomes for students by looking at how they make successful transitions from one part of the education system to the next? How do we remove barriers? How do we begin to think of the educational institution as an enterprise, not as separate chunks of your public investment? And how do we build better data systems so we know more about individual students? How do we develop better articulation agreements between institutions and better policies to allow that to happen? And lots of people are weighing in on those discussions. We have the Chalkboard Project, as you know, the Leaders Roundtable in Portland, the Oregon Business Council, the Oregon Business Association. We staff the work of the Quality Education Commission, and there are several other groups who'd like to have input and craft Oregon's public policy around education. The good news in our view of the world is that teachers and schools and school districts have delivered, student achievement has continued to improve, that the setting of standards and measuring against them has resulted in our ability to tell you how students are doing. You have the ability to look at those trend lines, and I believe you have the Oregon report card or the booklet that summarizes the report and this achievement of Oregon students over the last several years. The Act itself and the changes in the Act since 1991 have resulted in significant innovations in the system. We have created new learning environments. We have created charter schools. We have accommodated the acceleration of students on their individual pathways from finishing of high school onto their post-secondary experience. We have accommodated community and cross-institutional partnerships. We have the promise of technology and virtual learning before us, and we have some work to do there. We have acted on the science of brain research, and we have acted on the research behind successful interventions for teaching and learning in a variety of healthy ways. And the Superintendent of Public Instruction has set a clear set of priorities and initiatives for us at the Department of Education that are resulting in changes in the system as well. However, we know that Oregonians and Oregonians' own education community is not always in agreement about the vision and what should happen in the system. We know that high schools are not measuring up to the extent that we would like them. The previous person who testified mentioned that we do not have an adequate number of students meeting the standard in 10th grade, let alone 11th and 12th. The implementation of Oregon's Educational Act has not been systemic. We have pockets where there are true believers who have made it work magnificently, and we have other places who have not necessarily been able to embrace the vision and implement the changes as we would have expected. The demographics in Oregon have changed radically over the last years since the Act was passed. We are now managing a state-funded school system, as you know, and that has changed the nature of involvement of communities and parents in terms of their willingness to support their local schools. And there is lots of rhetoric, again, about the assessment system, about the SIM and CAM. Business and higher education have been accused of not asking for it, kids not valuing it. Not valuing the certificates. Educators don't all agree on how to implement the reform, and many of you think it costs too much. So what was once a grand vision for higher expectations and longer school years often now deteriorates into a discussion limited to what we don't want. with no apparent acknowledgement or excitement about what we do want. And in addition to all of that, Oregon has suffered in the last several years from the budget crisis that you're all very well aware of. It's our responsibility to assist you in crafting public policy, to implement the policy you enact, to interpret the laws you pass, to communicate and guide school districts as to the intent of the law, to provide research on best practices, to provide the outcomes demanded, to collect and analyze data about what is happening as a result, and to monitor and hold schools accountable to spend their resources wisely and efficiently to produce those outcomes. We're committed to this work. We also acknowledge that we've made mistakes. In retrospect, Oregon's Educational Act was one of the most visionary policy statements in the nation in 1991. And it was a top-down legislative mandate created without the full benefit of deliberation of parents, teachers, and communities at large in crafting a vision for their future. Much of the Act got it right, but the implementation has come with not a small measure of resistance. So we're here today to acknowledge the work of thousands of dedicated professionals in improving the success of hundreds of thousands of Oregon students, and to acknowledge that we have a long way to go. You've recently heard the governor talk about the need for addressing high school rigor. Superintendent Castillo has pointed to the disparity in achievement among Oregon students, the importance of literacy development, especially in middle and high school, and the importance of early childhood development. She is not, however, interested in words like abolish, eliminate, and dissolve. Rather, we want you to know if the Oregon Legislature is ready to craft a new vision, we stand ready to help. Our request of you is to be thoughtful and deliberative, to bring the crowd along with you, to allow teachers to contribute, to work with the State Board of Education and other education stakeholders so that we're all part of the solution for the future. We want you to know that we appreciate your willingness to grapple with the tough cultural and political issues and share with you the common goal of continuous improvement. Let's keep the best of what has been built and continue an informed evolution. Do the research, examine the best of what is happening across the country, and most importantly, engage Oregon in the creation of its own future in the global economy by making a reasonable and adequate investment in Oregon's educational enterprise. I believe that Dr. Burke has specific references to House Bill 3162, and I'm finished with my statement, and we'll just turn it over to him. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer of the Department of Education. And here to speak in opposition to 3162, but within the context of the comments that my colleague Vicki Fleming just made. And I want to talk a little about the specifics in the bill and then talk about a set of broader issues that need to be considered and then possibility of a way through this this debate. Let me talk first about the specifics of the bill. The bill does three things. It eliminates any mention of the certificates of initial and advanced mastery from the existing statute. It also removes any reference to the types of assessments to be used in the measurement of student achievement. And then it directs the department to contract with an independent organization to develop an assessment system that would meet the requirements of the Federal No Child Left Behind Act. So let me talk about those three major thrusts of the bill for just a moment. First of all, any changes in the assessment system must be reviewed by federal authorities for compliance with No Child Left Behind. Now, we've done this three times already. The way this works is usually done in collaboration with the U.S. Department over a series of months of discussing what the issues are and what the proposed change in the state's response to the regulation would be, and eventually securing approval from the U.S. Department of Education. And as I said, we've already amended our adequate yearly progress plan, it's called, three times with the U.S. Department of Education in the last 2 years. Removing language from the current law that references criterion reference testing and performance assessments removes from the law the basis upon which we would know if Oregon students are meeting Oregon standards. Now, every assessment system that I'm aware of undergoes some form of refinement and improvement. Even the normed reference tests that we have been talking about go through the same thing. These tests are continually updated. Their test items are recalibrated, and norming takes place. A real key question whenever you're looking at a normed reference test is to ask, what group was this test normed on, and what year was the norming did the norming take place? Both of which are key questions if you consider using a normed reference test. Any system needs to be upgraded. The same is being done with the Oregon assessment system as we speak. And these changes require research. You don't do this willy-nilly. You have to consider carefully any change in an assessment system, whether it's criterion referenced or normed referenced. There's no consideration in the current language for the potential costs of the new assessments. Changing the existing system to another may actually cost the department additional funds due to the conversion costs. For us to remain in compliance with No Child Left Behind, we would have to show that whatever assessment we used aligned to our state standards. That's a statistical process, and we would have to invest in that process. There's no provision in the bill that would allow the department to bid on the assessments. It directs the department automatically to contract out. And as you know, we have taken a number of steps to reduce the cost of the assessment system, not the least of which is the development and wide distribution of the online assessment system, which dramatically lowers the cost and provides instant return information to the student and the classroom teacher. Another point is that the federal law requires states to establish their own set of academic content standards, requires states to establish a set of measurements specifically targeted to those standards, and then the law requires the use of what's called item analysis, and quoting from the law, in such a manner that the school and the parent would know from the results how the student is performing on those standards. So if you understand those three elements, the current proposal before you would require the department to turn around and recreate the existing system. Now, simply purchasing an Iowa or the California Test of Basic Skills or any other off-the-shelf test does not fulfill that requirement of the law. That's the additional work that would have to be done to align that assessment to the state standards. And I want to make an additional point here about this. I've been doing this for a long time. I've done a lot of training over the last 15 to 20 years of teachers and principals in standards-based instructional methodologies. My fear is that you could substitute the Certificate of Initial Mastery for the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, and we would be sitting here talking about teachers who interrupt their instruction to get ready for the Iowa. The issue is not the assessment. The issue is good instruction. And if you have any teacher who comes before you or any principal who comes before you and says, I have to stop teaching in order to prepare my kids for the assessment, the first thing that should go off in your head is that's not good instruction. And it's not. These assessments reflect what students have learned in the classroom so that the concepts, the standards, the ability to apply knowledge and skill should be a regular part of classroom instruction. You will not find in any of our recommendations that people stop their classroom work in order to prepare kids, or as the term is sometimes used, teach to the test. There is a difference between teaching to a test and ensuring that my instruction contains the material that the state of Oregon is holding me accountable for. That's a different issue. That's called mapping my instruction and making sure that my instruction contains the material that I'm going to hold my students accountable for. Very simply, if we give a test in high school on geometric reasoning, some of the problems in the math test include geometry, but a student has not had good instruction in geometry, preparing the kid on how to take the test won't help. The issue is good instruction and using those standards to guide my instruction. Finally, the complete repeal of 329.445 in the law directs the department, that statute directs the department to review district improvement plans around the improvement of middle school instruction, and frankly, I don't see what that particular part of this bill has to do with SIM and CAM. It has more to do, 445 has more to do with improving middle schools. So let me now very briefly turn to a broader set of issues. 3162 does not address the concerns that I've heard not only in this session, but in all of the past sessions, as Ms. Fleming pointed out, from the very beginning in 1991, there have been issues. Now, Oregon has a set of standards that have been widely recognized for their quality and their rigor. However, as we have testified before this committee earlier in the session, there are a number of issues that need some attention. Let me highlight some of them. Whether there needs to be better alignment of standards to instruction, especially in the high school, and I've testified before this committee about this issue, so that if, for example, we require 2 years of mathematics for a high school diploma, and that can be pre-algebra and algebra, that body of content does not contain the information that's on the state assessment. And whether you gave that student an Iowa test of basic skills or the SIM test or any test, if you say it's important for high school kids to understand geometry, but we haven't taught them, we've set them up to fail. So the issue becomes, can we use the standards to guide our instruction and make sure that we have better alignment to our instructional program? We need to question whether there needs to be better alignment between the assessments and instruction, particularly in high school. We have to examine the graduation requirements themselves, particularly in English, math, and science. And if we do that, how would we go about increasing those requirements? What would that cost? How many teachers do we need? We need some investigation. We would want to examine the current performance standards and assessments for their statistical accuracy. As we've testified before the committee before, what we are seeing is the average third and fifth grade scores in the state are now considerably above the original performance standards that were established in 1996, the standard being 201 for third graders. The average performance last year was 214. That would lead me to conclude that this needs some reexamination of the calibration of the system. It's the same thing that you do in a normed reference test. Over a period of time, you continually analyze your results, then you recalibrate. Whether the existing performance assessments are reliable and cost-effective. We certainly agree, as you've heard today and at other times, issues of the performance assessments, the writing assessment, the math problem-solving assessment. We need to look at that carefully and analyze what changes need to be made. Whether our standards can be linked to the preparation of Oregon students for success after high school. This is the challenge that the governor has given all of us, both the legislature, higher ed, and the Department of Education, to examine that carefully. Whether there is a need to develop more accurate assessments for English language learners. I've discussed with this committee our use of Spanish assessments in reading and writing and mathematics to assist our students. And whether the current system is relevant to students. Certainly agree, as you have heard from some students, that if no one asks me about this, if no one treats this as something important, why would I conclude as a student that this is important? Now, more broadly than that, I believe that there are a couple of basic functions. We want to know if what we teach our students, are our students learning what we expect of them. And what No Child Left Behind does, as you recall, I talked about this earlier, the dilemma before the U.S. Congress was whether or not to set that nationally, which would take that away from states, or to direct states to develop their own. And the compromise that was reached in Congress was to direct states to develop their own, but to require all states to participate in the national assessment of educational progress. That's where you get the common assessment that all states take, and you can compare state-to-state performance across the United States. Second, can we give information that helps inform instruction for our teachers? Can we develop a system that's even better at giving feedback to teachers in a timely manner? And can we give taxpayers an indication that their $7 billion investment in education is paying off for them? Now, these are all areas that we believe need careful analysis and development of new recommendations to strengthen the current system. Simply eliminating the names, you can cut SIM and CAM out of the law, but that will not get you to the deeper design work that needs to be done. So what have we learned so far? We agree, as you have heard before your committee, that some of the requirements imposed under the Oregon Education Act for the 21st century in 1991, and again modified in 1995, need to be reevaluated as the system evolves. I don't think any system should be locked in stone. These systems will continually evolve. The problems that arose during the implementation of the original act, as Ms. Fleming talked about, were largely driven by it being top-down without the involvement of stakeholders and, in a way, imposed on the legislature. I won't want to get into the argument about an unfunded mandate. I think the Oregon legislature provides funding for education. It was up to schools, school districts, superintendents, and my agency to make sure that we did the absolute best we could with the resources provided. And the standards in the assessment system provide essential information for us to do that. The system was built on the values of increasing rigor in the classroom and making coursework more relevant to students, and I believe those are still goals today. We need to build an accountability system so we know if we're being successful, who is not being successful, and then providing guidance for us on how to improve. We still want our education system built on those values. I think those values are as alive today as ever. However, much has changed in the last 14 years. It's a good time now to reevaluate the system and to use the joint boards of education to create a better aligned system for pre-kindergarten through college education and college graduation. The reason I say that is that there has been a coming together, a consensus of will that I've watched emerge over the last year, year and a half, around the importance of looking at this as an enterprise pre-kindergarten through university and aligning the system for more efficiency and more opportunity for our students. And I think all elements, higher ed, community colleges, and K-12, are ready for that work. I believe there's a better approach to this problem to be found in establishing a process for the in-depth analysis that I'm talking about, to look at the current system, to focus on all of the components of the system, not a piecemeal approach. We really need to look at this in a comprehensive fashion. So you can't just look at the assessment system without talking about the instructional system. You can't talk about the instructional system without talking about how we prepare teachers to deliver instruction. These are all interrelated components. You've probably also seen the articles recently about both the revised SAT and the ACT examinations. This has received a lot of attention in the press in the last couple of weeks. They are now focusing increasingly on academic rigor and demonstrations of proficiency. The Oregon University system still has a requirement for the entering class of 07, specific demonstrations of academic proficiency, not just grade point averages. The new SAT exam will use a writing assessment that is scored in the same manner that the Oregon writing assessment is scored on. So, Representative Roblin, having students who understand the criteria for effective writing and can apply those criteria to self-correcting and editing their work is an essential skill to prepare our students. Now, this will take time, though, to do the kind of comprehensive study that I'm talking about. You don't do this without research. You have to involve stakeholders. So let's make sure that we don't recreate the problems we did in the past. And there is a role here for national experts to provide assistance to us. In a real simplistic way, you have to... the three basic components. What are your intended outcomes? What do we want kids to know in this state? We have to know that we have an instructional system that delivers that, and we have to have an assessment system that tells us whether or not they're learning it. It's really not hard. There are basic questions that need to be answered. So while we oppose 3162 in its current form, I just want to reiterate what Vicki said. We look forward to an opportunity to have a more in-depth conversation about this, not necessarily in legislative hearing, but doing the kind of in-depth work that would need to be done prior to making a comprehensive set of recommendations to the legislature. So attached to your presentation, copy of my notes, we are submitting proposed amendments to 3162. And those amendments, I won't go through them now for the committee's review, but it takes language that would in some ways be very similar to language that is contained in House Bill 3180, in both bills, either in the amendment or in 3180. You can see that what is proposed is an interim study process directing the joint boards of education, who are appointed by the governor from every region in the state, to engage in the in-depth analysis on the types of questions that I've indicated, and to prepare by October of 06 a set of recommendations for legislative interim committees to review prior to the 07 session. So thank you, Madam Chair, for your time, and I'll stop there.
Are there any questions for Dr. Burke? Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Dr. Burke, you mentioned that in your specific issues that the cost of assessments in this conversion might result in more costs to the department and I assume and or school districts. So from that assessment, I would think that this probably, if it passes in its current form, would need to go through the Ways and Means process as well.
Madam Chair, Representative March, I would assume so. And there are some costs that we are having somewhat of a difficult time getting a handle on because they're intangible. One of them is the degree to which Oregon teachers have internalized the current set of standards, and they use them in their instruction. So if you change the standards, one of the implied costs is you've got to start your professional development process all over again. You have to reorient 55,000 teachers to a new set of standards. That will not be cheap, but it would be something that we don't yet have a precise number on. In addition to that, the more immediate cost is if you take an assessment that is not already aligned to the standard, you then have to go through a statistical process to align it. There are a variety of ways to do that. One of them is side-by-side testing. Test the same kids on two different assessments and you statistically compare the results. Another is to embed test items into another assessment so that you can compare items to known items. There are a variety of strategies. None of them are cheap, and they would all require some work and some cost.
Thank you.
Representative Dahl.
Yes, Dr. Burke, when you talk about what we should do, and correct me if I'm making a mistake, but in the early 90s when Vera Katz and Norma Paulus pressed the Oregon Education Act through this body, I believe it went through almost unanimously with one dissenting vote, Senator Magee. And I think it had all the promise you talk about and all the promise that that your request where your recommendations would engender. In fact, I remember the Chancellor of Higher Ed talking about the great thing that Oregon had done. In your opinion, what went wrong?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlin, first of all, I'm not sure anything went wrong. We have to ask some basic questions about system alignment. That's one place that I would look. Even with the districts, or with the results that we received in the math problem-solving assessment this year, which we have talked about with this committee, when we look at districts that hit math problem-solving as a fundamental part of their teacher professional development, in other words, they focused on the instructional program, students in those districts did quite well, even with an assessment item that we think was flawed. So one of the issues, it's not so much the system itself, but it's the level of teacher preparation. Secondly, I think and you heard this comment earlier, it's one that I actually agree with. I'm not sure that teachers have enough preparation, particularly in their pre-licensing programs, on incorporating assessment practices into the classroom. Let me give you an example from a recent study. It just came out in February. State of Kentucky, the Pritchard Institute in Lexington, Kentucky, published something called Unlocking the Black Box of High-Performing High-Poverty Schools. It's a very interesting study. It's an in-depth analysis of 8 schools in the state of Kentucky by education audit committees that spent months in these schools documenting what they were doing. These are high-poverty schools achieving high results. Very interestingly, Representative Dahlem, the teachers in those schools downplayed the importance of the Kentucky education assessment system because that was done once a year and it helped validate what they were doing. They paid more attention and described more benefit by professional development on classroom-based instruction. So when they talk with these teachers about what makes the difference in this school, one of the things was we pay attention to our daily assessments. It's not that the state assessment was not important, but it wasn't what was driving change. It was the teachers focusing on their classroom. And I guess the third thing I would say is certainly judging from testimony and my own experience over the last 15 years trying to implement this, the whole communications issue around state standards and assessments has not been done well. I don't believe there should ever be any question of whether or not an employer, for example, expects someone coming to work for them to be well prepared. The colleges and universities have used data on 10th grade performance to analyze the success of students at the end of the first year of college work, both in the community colleges and the university. There's a very clear connection, but that information is also not widely known or distributed. So I believe we've not communicated very well about these issues.
And if the recommendations that you provided were implemented and we stayed the course, what assurance do we have that after 13 years to talk about communication not happening? What would make communication happen in the next 13?
Right. Representative Flores, Representative Dahlem, I'm not suggesting that we stay the course. I'm suggesting that these are the types of issues that need a really in-depth analysis. I think it's a very appropriate question to go back to the university system and say, how come high school graduates don't know whether or not you require a certificate of initial mastery? And I would just take out of that the title certificate of initial mastery and say, what's the incentive that you can provide for a student to demonstrate that they have mastered rigorous academic standards? If that's meaningful to you, how do you incorporate that into your admissions process? Now, you have the legislature has before it a bill that would add to the Oregon Opportunity Grant and provide a $500 tuition stipend for students who meet state standards by the time they graduate from high school. We've talked to students about that. We have a student advisory team that we meet with on a regular basis, and the students tell us that those are the kinds of very specific things that they would like to see more of. Their response to us, Representative Dahlem, has been very straightforward. They said, if it's important to adults that we reach high academic standards, then act like it. And what they've said to us is, don't hustle us. If it doesn't mean anything to you whether or not I meet high standards, then cut all this stuff out. If it is meaningful to you, then we will respond to that expectation.
Follow
up. Yes, let's... what exactly, and we'll drive this closer to home, we'll make you the superintendent of public instruction. What would you do with the Department of Education that would ensure that these recommendations were implemented? What would you do at home?
Well, we would do some of the things that we are currently doing, which is to streamline the assessment system, to look at not only internally, but the use of outside consultants, whether or not the flaws that we have seen in the past year have solutions, and we would examine alternatives. That's one of the things we're proposing, Representative Dahlem, to do that work over the interim. The next is that I do believe that, as I mentioned earlier, working with the universities on how we prepare teachers and do professional development is an important step, and we are doing a lot of that with our campuses right now. The third is to continue to use technology as a way of building out the system. The use of the online system not only lowers cost very dramatically, but it also provides more immediate feedback to kids and to teachers. And finally, I think one of the things that I think is really critical here is that we have to do a better job as an agency in communicating the results, making sure people understand what the results mean, putting out information that is understandable. Let me give you an example of what we're currently working on. We're going to talk about this later today. The law requires that we establish a report card, and we do that. But we do it in a way that can be printed front and back on a single piece of paper because districts have to mail it home. That means that it's real tiny type, it's only in black and white, and the graphics and other information are very limited. And for the most part, it's done in English. So if you were to say, could we improve how we communicate how schools are doing in the state, I would say absolutely yes. And those are the types of things that we are anxious to keep moving on.
Well, what has kept you from doing these things in the past?
Representative Flores, Representative Dahlem, nothing. We have been working on this for the last several years. For example, the implementation of the online assessment system is a result of that. Mr. Costi can tell you how many tests we have administered online this year, but it is in the hundreds of thousands. We have revised and reviewed the state report card several times. We have streamlined our use of what's called the secured student identifier. You may have seen the article in the Oregonian a couple of days ago where that new technology has been used to do a very precise analysis on the academic achievement of the 8 districts in Multnomah County. We've never had these tools before, and we're using them to provide better and more precise data on student achievement. So I believe we are continuing to refine and move the system forward. And as I said, we have amended our federal plan 3 times already, and as I've testified before this committee, we are aggressively moving toward a better alignment of the state system and the federal system, and we are delighted to hear Secretary Spellings has already indicated some interest in moving forward with growth models, which, as you recall, was a major issue for us in our adequate yearly progress plan.
One final question.
And with this caveat, I think we do have one other bill we want to hear. We have 2 other people that want to testify on this bill. This will not be the last visit here. We will be having another public hearing on this bill.
With that in mind, I'll wait.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I might propose that we have a limit on follow-up questions from now on.
Representative Farr, I've never known you to be out-followed up. Were you going to ask a question?
I would be, if you would like to wait, since you're asking them to come back so that we can move on.
Would you be willing to come back at our next hearing and proceed with testimony? Thank you very much. And Mr. Coffey, I didn't want to cut you off at the pass. However, I saw you were preparing to make some comments.
That's all right. I'll wait.
Thank you. Then I would like to call Beth Ann Darby, and then after her will be Jason Williams.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Education Association. The OEA represents approximately 43,000 community college faculty, classified education professionals, and K-12 teachers. OEA opposes House Bill 3162 in its current form because it abolishes the Certificate of Initial Mastery and CAM, and also directs OD to outsource development and implementation of Oregon's statewide assessment system. Since its inception, SimCam has been the subject of much criticism, legislative review, and ultimately fine-tuning. OEA has participated in all, at all of these levels, including critique. We've also been happy to say part of the helping to support its reform as well. Most recently, OEA supported House Bill 2744 in the 2003 legislature. With that process, a very long process that this House Education Committee undertook, the SimCam was revised substantially. It was limited to only the subject areas required by No Child Left Behind. The portfolio requirements and other work samples that many have found controversial and objectionable were made optional, made an issue of local control. And additional endorsements were also made an issue of local control, allowing school districts to adjust the curriculum that they're sending to our students based on their own needs and local issues. It also, House Bill 2744 also delayed implementation of CAM. OEA prefers a holistic education complete with high standards and opportunity for all Oregon students that includes access to social studies, physical education, foreign language, music, and arts. We understand, however, that this approach is not possible given Oregon's current budget and revenue choices. OEA opposes the use of off-the-shelf assessments produced by private companies because it wastes the investment that Oregon has already made into its assessment system. It will likely be more expensive than our current system, and there is no evidence to suggest that it will yield a better result, only that we will no longer know whether Oregon students are meeting Oregon standards. OEA is proud that our members have participated in the development of the test questions used in our current assessment system. Oregon teachers also ensure that Oregon standards are being taught to our students by participating in the scoring of the performance components, the writing and problem solving exercises that make our state assessment of such high caliber. Oregon has an asset in its testing system. And in fact, in one of your interim committees, I was just recalling, I think that there was testimony provided to you that suggested that other states might be interested in using our assessment tool. For some reason, I remember there was a conversation about that. If Oregon were to outsource its assessment system, any publisher's test would have to be remodeled to gear it to Oregon content standards, and Oregon would have to pay for this realignment. The federal government has not established national standards for academic achievement in English, math, and science. Instead, it requires that Oregon develop its own standards and assessment geared towards those standards. Also, our current assessment system has been approved by the federal government as meeting federal standards. Adopting any other system would require extensive redevelopment and require that the Oregon Department of Education seek approval from the federal government for the new system. At your January 21, 2005 informational meeting, the Oregon Department of Education testified that Oregon currently has a 30,000 question bank of tests valued at $300 to $350 per question. They also testified that annually Oregon spends approximately $3.7 million for item writing, development, and delivery of its assessment. This works out to about $12.85 per test based on 288,168 tests delivered in the 2003-2004 academic year. In contrast, Mr. Rob Kramer also testified that a 2003 request for proposal from a leading publisher, sorry, my mouth's getting a little dry, McGraw-Hill produced a contract price for $13 to $18 million to develop and administer an off-the-shelf assessment tool. I think that's the only information that we've received in this legislative session about the cost of development of an off-the-shelf or nationally normed test. Clearly, abolishment of SimCam in favor of an off-the-shelf system is not cost-effective if those numbers hold true. In this time of limited and, in some cases, non-existent resources, it would be unwise to throw out an assessment system that aligns to state standards, that teachers and students understand, and that helps Oregon meet federal requirements. To begin all over in this process would be an extreme waste of time, training, and money. OEA members have been saying the same thing for several years. The real issue in the state isn't the state assessment system, it's our funding system. Students thrive, stay in school, gain self-esteem, and are prepared for competing in a global economy because of opportunities available in comprehensive education programs. OEA urges the legislature to focus its attention on the big picture and to begin to craft real solutions with real resources and allow all of Oregon's students access to the education and skills they will need to flourish.
Any questions for Ms. Darby? I know you're afraid to now, right? She'll be back.
I'm sure I'll be back. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Jason Williams.
Chair Flores, member of the committee, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. I'm very thankful to be here, and especially since, you know, over the years, I just want to congratulate the committee for really making a good spotlight on our education reform here. It always hasn't been as open and as focused as it is now. I think that it's very healthy for the process. The committee is passing out our statement and also a report I did a few years ago for Oregon Tax Research called What Teachers Think, where I interviewed teachers. It was done in 2001-2002, so it's kind of a time capsule capturing a moment in time. Some of the SIMACAM changes have been made. But I think it's very relevant to find out on how when you micromanage and when you overregulate, sometimes you can run into problems. And on my testimony, I love this quote about a report about what makes successful schools, and one of the principals said, all low-performing schools have one thing in common. They allow too many things to disrupt the classroom instruction. And I think that it should be really a guiding principle to anything that we do, because we're always thinking of new things we want to add to that list. Well, as you start getting to number 10 and 11 on your list, you start watering down everything on that list and really threatening what you really want to accomplish. And some of the things I learned when I did the report was just, you know, for instance, with this idea about reinventing the grading system and how teachers had to be, you know, retrained to do a grading through a 1-6 grading system. And I remember having a teacher who taught around the world, and when he came to Portland, he was like, this is kind of a strange system. And of course, every year when he had new students, he'd have to tell them, and the students said, well, what does a 5 mean? Because, you know, they usually know what an A through F is. They know what a 90% is. They know what a 75% is. They don't know what a 5 out of 1-6 is. So he'd have to explain it to the students every year. It'd just be something new. As a new batch of students come in, of course, as you explain it to the students, then you have to go and explain it to the parents, because they would say, well, what does a 5 mean? Or what does a 4 mean? Is it an A? Is it a B? And it just kind of represents how someone gets an idea about how to change something, and we lose our focus on simplicity and efficiency and effectiveness, and that, you know, hurts us all in the long run. And some of the things that I was learning in this report, that a lot of teachers felt like they were losing some of their best teachers in this process because of SIM and CAM, because of the overregulation. And the teachers who seemed to like it were the ones that had nothing to compare it against. I thought that was kind of an interesting comparison. But those that had been there a long time, had seen a lot of different teaching methods and had a successful teaching method of their own, that those seemed to be moving on or had the greatest criticisms for SIM and CAM. There's been talk about with the cost savings in terms of the testing and the audits report, and with the idea with the testing. When I look at the testing up from the 10-year mark of the SIM and CAM, looking how we changed on the national assessment of the progress test, that I didn't see any significant change in Oregon. And that should be one of the real examples when we look at the system, is if we're putting this money in and if we're expecting this out of all of our teachers, we have this new system and it doesn't affect our national testing, then why don't we go to something that's more teacher-friendly and give them a chance to see if they can boost up their test scores? That, to me, it should be one of the major key things that this committee should look at, is if it's not changing how well we do on the NAEP test, then, you know, why are we holding on to it so dear? When I think about teachers, and when you think about teachers, think about your favorite teachers of when you grew up. And I came to two conclusions of what made your favorite teacher. Number one, they spent a lot of time with you. after class or in class, or number two, they really had a very creative way of teaching. And those, to me, are just kind of the keystones about good teaching. But when you have an overregulated thing like Sim and Cam, and when you are micromanaging, you're taking that away, because you're taking away their time because they have to do all this other requirements, and you're taking away their freedom. When the curriculum becomes so intensive, you begin to micromanage their thing, and so we begin to lose what we love best about our public schools and what we like best about our teachers, because we begin to take that away. And I know that sometimes the proponents of Sim and Cam will come and they will say, look, our school has done this wonderful program, and if it wasn't for Sim and Cam, we wouldn't have done that. Well, but to me, every time they say they did this wonderful program, there is 100 little mini stories of wonderful programs that were never done because the teacher couldn't do it, because they were forced into this one avenue. So it gets back to our focus on, you know, on the basics, on the reading, writing, and math. And we need to do whatever we can to get those test scores up and continue to go up. So that's kind of what the Taxpayer Association hopes that we can really focus in on, is reducing that, what we can, to make it as easy for the teachers to set a benchmark in terms of the basics, but getting rid of a lot of that superfluous stuff that does exist in Sim and Cam. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Any questions? Representative Farr.
Just a quick one. Jason, how many teachers did you survey for this report?
Close to 30. It also included educators and some school board members and
okay.
curriculum people.
So 30 total?
Yeah.
30 involved in the process. Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up? Not that I'm going to be counting.
You make an excellent point. I'll only do one follow-up. And since teachers' input is so important, do you agree that teachers should be able to weigh in on a change in assessment policy, since they're the ones that are doing the assessing?
Yes. Chair Flores, members of the committee, and this would be a really good recommendation I'd have with you, is that, you know, this is, I mean, it's a lot of anecdotal stuff, and I'm not going to say I did it, you know, I'm a huge scientist or anything, but one of the things I did learn is that I had to do it anonymously, because there were a lot of things that teachers just won't share, and I really learned that there really is a kind of a, teachers really have a big servant's heart, and there really is kind of a drive towards coming together and agreeing together and serving who's ever telling you what you need to do. And I think that that gets abused in our system. And so a lot of times, if you do invite teachers, you might not get the actual representation from teachers. And so I'd say, as you guys are committee members, sometimes going back in your communities and just having a good coffee, having a good talk, I think that will give you the full picture. Because I remember, I don't know if I talked about it in my report, but there was one guy who disagreed with what the decision was on the math curriculum in the school, and it was like, wait a minute, you're not supposed to disagree with what the administrators and the appointed teachers say. And there was kind of this culture of, hey, you can't disagree, we all come together on this stuff. And he was ostracized, and it sounds kind of funny, but that stuff does happen. And so there is kind of a groupthink that does affect our education system. So I would really encourage you, as you talk to teachers, make sure to try more untraditional avenues of reaching them outside of this process, because sometimes this process doesn't always bring a full representation.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad you pointed out the not a scientist, because I see its report's not a statistical sampling, and I question whether 30 is dozens of teachers, but as quoted in your report. But more specifically, there was some discussion about testing and whether the tests, if we're brought in outside testing systems, and that actually resulted in a more expensive testing system. Would your organization be in favor of that?
Chair Flores, member of the committees, I imagine there would be. There's a lot of different testing companies out there, and when I look at what happened last year where the state created math tests, you know, had that 80% of the students fail that math test, that suddenly, wait a minute, maybe we're going to have some big problems here on ourselves. Maybe we should begin looking elsewhere. I mean, that was a big error on their part. So I would I would like to see other testing. And I know, and having talked to other testing companies, I haven't talked specifically about price, but I know that they are saying, one of the things they communicated to me is, hey, you know, you should tell us what you want kids to know. We can build a test around that. So they're very user-friendly. They would, if we come up with Oregon standards, they would love to build a test around our standards.
Well, that didn't answer the question, but fine. Thank you.
I'm sure you'll be back too, Mr. Williams. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've closed the public hearing on House Bill 3162 to be revisited. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3186. Mr. Keller.
House Bill 3186 repeals requirement that the Superintendent of Public Instruction produce annual school district and school performance reports, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005, and it does not have a subsequent renewal. Referral.
Renewal, referral. I see Dr. Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for my cold. Seems every time I come before this committee, I have a cold. I don't know if there's a connection or not.
It's the building.
I think maybe. For the record, I'm Pat Burke, Chief Policy Officer of the Department of Education, and here to discuss House Bill 3186. 3186 proposes the repeal of the requirement that the Superintendent of Public Instruction produce an annual school, district, and school performance reports, and repeal would be effective July 2005. As currently worded, the department does not support 3186. And I'd like to talk a little bit about why, because I want to clearly say that we are not opposed to changes in the report card. So we'll talk specifically about the current wording and then where we might go from here. In 1995, the legislature directed that each school or school district issue a report card, and that these report cards be disseminated to the public. In earlier testimony, I've reviewed with this committee the timelines that we follow in doing that. Those timelines are established in statute. In 2001, the Federal No Child Left Behind Act became effective and also required school-level report cards, but it allowed states that already had school report cards to modify those report cards to include the information required under the law. Attached to my sample testimony is the language from the federal law, and I refer you to section 2 near the bottom of the first page, where local education agencies, that is school districts, are required to have report cards. And if you turn to the next page, B, the minimum requirements, the state education agency shall ensure that each local agency, that is the school district, collects appropriate data and includes in the local education agency's annual report the information described in the paragraph as applied to the agency and each school served by the local education agency.
Excuse me, Dr. Burke, where is this from?
This is from Federal No Child Left Behind Act, Section 1111, which outlines the requirements for states and local districts. So, as the federal law then requires school, district, and state-level report cards to be created, all schools, in order to remain compliant with the federal law, would need to submit the same data. So one question, that, concern that we have about 3186 is that if we eliminated the state requirement to create the report card, would this possibly represent a cost shift to school districts where they would have to create their own report card in order to remain in compliance with No Child Left Behind? So let me again refer you to the federal law down at the bottom of the second page under number 3, where it says pre-existing report cards. A state educational agency or local education agency that was providing public report cards on the performance of students, schools, and local agencies, or at the state level prior to the enactment of No Child Left Behind, may use those report cards for the purpose of this section. So what we have done in Oregon with the implementation of No Child Left Behind is that we continue to use the report cards that were being prepared by the state agency, and those are sent to the local districts, and they use those report cards to comply with the federal law. So if we were not doing this, this was removed from the state's responsibility, one possible implication is that local districts would have to create their own. Now, we could, another way of looking at this, is modify the state report card to include less information than it currently has. I'm sorry, the state report card for the local district. And we need to distinguish between three items here. The state report card, which is the booklet that you have in your hand. That information is a compilation of data from throughout the state. I think it provides a wealth of information on schools and school performance in the state. The second is a district report card, and the third is a local school report card. Currently, the Department of Education produces all three in compliance with No Child Left Behind. But, for example, in a discussion regarding a modification of the report card, we have already indicated to this committee our concern that we better align the federal requirements and the state requirements. For example, the grading of schools as exceptional, strong, satisfactory, low, or unacceptable could be discussed. We provide information on attendance rates, school safety, parent and community involvement, and students who meet or exceed standard. How do we provide that information in an accurate and clear way? In addition to the above things that I just mentioned, on the state, on the district report cards, we provide a lot of information on resident students who attend a public school other than in their school district. We provide information on facilities that are used for distance learning. We look at election results, and that's published on whether or not there was a bond levy at the local district. We provide information on the level of support from the ESD in that district. We provide information on staffing, including administrators and teachers in the district. We provide information on SAT scores and on class size. All of those things are, we think, helpful and good information to provide to the public, but they are certainly things that we could discuss. The elimination of some of these categories could result in savings, both for schools or for the department, but the amount of savings would be somewhat difficult to assess. We'd have to look at what we would stop collecting and what the cost implication of that. So as I've said, we have been working and we've reported to this committee on the idea of merging the state and federal reports to eliminate confusion, particularly the confusion that comes from a rating under the state report card that might or might not agree with the adequate yearly progress report. As I've testified before, you would have some students, some schools that would be identified as satisfactory or indeed even exemplary on the report card, but have not made adequate yearly progress. That is very confusing to the public, to us, and to you, and that's an area, Madam Chair, where we think the report cards could be improved. We think that our schools have expressed support to amend the report cards. We've been out talking with superintendents and principals and teachers around the state. as you have heard me say before, I am very concerned about the current federal regulation that sets a bar, and you're either above the bar or not. And we have proposed working on a growth model as an alternative to that. And again, we are optimistic, as I said earlier, that seems to be more openness in Washington, D.C. for that approach. We agree that the report card needs change. It needs to be easier to read, probably more along the lines of a data profile of a school district. And the how all of that would come together, we think, is probably part of this broader conversation that I discussed earlier with the committee on 3162. This is part of that bigger picture, looking at the system in a more comprehensive way. How do we report results to the public? So I'll stop there, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Representative March.
Thank you. Two things, Madam Chair. One is, as a voter in Multnomah County and representing part of Multnomah County, I want to thank the department for working with our eight local school districts and local officials to actually show that directed money to the classroom makes improvements where you want improvements to do. And the database initiative and your work has really helped in that. So thank you, and thanks to the department. But secondly, as a member of the legislature who hopefully is going to put out more than well over $5 billion towards K through 12 education, I'm very interested in being able to say to the voters out there how money is spent and what we're getting when we get bang for the buck. And so I would like to see us do some work on making, you know, us a little more compatible with the No Child Left Behind and annual yearly progress. But I don't want to see us losing a lot of really good, helpful information that will help teachers in the classroom. So I'd welcome looking at this in a long period, you know, getting together with all of the partners in education and saying, how do we make this thing work?
Thank you. That prompts a question. Dr. Burke, and some of your suggestions, you're saying, well, perhaps we could not collect this data or this data or this data, but would you not still be collecting that for purposes of the database initiative?
Madam Chair, some of it we would, and I think one of the things we would want to do is scrutinize all of our collections, and we've been doing a lot of this, to make sure that we're collecting information that people want and need and is useful. And if it's not, if it doesn't fit that category, we shouldn't be doing it. And likewise, just in response to Representative Martin, we are looking at new tools and how we can use new tools to replace some information that we may report. For example, what we've done in Multnomah County is this: using the Secured Student Identifier, or SSID. This is the first time we've been able to do this. So the question, basic question, is how do students do in a district over time? It's a real fundamental question. Prior to this year, we really didn't have the tool to answer that question. Now we do, and we can expand the use of that information into the report card. So a basic question is it valuable to the public and to principals and teachers and others to know how students did in the same district or the same school over time? The current report cards do not provide that information. So when you see the charts on the report card, it's the third grade 3 years ago, the third grade 2 years ago, and the current third grade, actually now the current fourth grade, but it's all specific to a grade level. With SSID, we can now monitor progress of students in the same district or the same school, frankly, any place in the state over a period of time. That's a very powerful tool.
The state report card that we currently have, as I understood it, with the information available through the, now that I've already introduced, DBI, is historically 1 to 2 years old by time it's printed and presented. So it's very difficult to make any current or future assessments based on the old information.
Madam Chair, that is correct. We update the DBI data following the balancing out and final resolution of the costs resolution of the district balances. That usually takes 6 to 8 months following the end of the fiscal year to do the audits, get the audits in, make any changes or adjustments, and then upload that information into DBI. So it is behind. But the DBI data is not necessarily what is used in the school report card or the district report card. That tends to be more information that comes from a direct student collection. Districts report to us specific pieces of information. And then that goes into a computerized process to gather and report all of that information in a consistent manner. So actually, there's a lot of information that does not come from DBI. In the booklet that I gave you, that state information, there's a lot of information in there that's not really a part of the database initiative. So we get information from a variety of sources.
Any additional questions? Dr. Burke. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pat, what do you think the savings would be once you bring the school report card into alignment with the No Child Left Behind report card? Or do you foresee any savings?
I would foresee some savings. I'm looking over my shoulder at Doug, who collects a lot of the information. I personally have not, I don't know if we have a good financial fiscal analysis of if we stopped doing something and then replaced it with something else, what would it cost? I can share with you that what we are looking for in the work that we're doing is to really minimize the amount of information that would have to go into a formula. That's where your costs go up, because you've got to do that in a statistically reliable manner, and it has to be done objectively in the same way for every school and every district. So we would try to focus on what are the minimums that would be needed for determining a decision to intervene on a report card. That's what both state law and the federal law requires to do. Then other information, we would move more to a data profile. And that data profile might even be available online versus in pencil paper. And the more we can drive to putting it online, the more we can save in the overall cost of the system. Doug?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, a couple things come to mind. Dr. Burke's correct in that many of these data would be kept for other purposes.
And for the record?
The formula, however, would be the... I'm sorry.
And for the record?
And for the record, my name is Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent of Assessment and Information Services.
Thank you.
Specifically to your question about savings and where the savings would be, there's two areas. That would be in the coding of the formula, this thing that creates the greater ranking, and help desk issues that result. So when we issue a report card, many of our staff are focused on answering questions from the district. So I have two or three people that are assigned just to routing calls to different offices to address those issues. And primarily that's because the districts are faced with a rating and they're really scrambling to take a look at deep diving into their data and making sure the data are correct and that everything is going into the formula correctly. So those are the areas. I have been requested by Joint Ways and Means to do a calculation of the savings if we were to pull AYP and or separate AYP and report card costs. So that's how I'm looking at it, is from that perspective.
Okay. I suspect we'll have you back to have a further discussion on this bill as well. Thank you very much. Close public hearing on House Bill 3186. Any additional? No further business to come before this committee. We will send adjourned. Thank you very much.